From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the political scramble to replace the late Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson.
A lot of jockeying, a lot of changes in decision-making here over the past week and a half with the Board of Commissioners.
The head of the Detroit Zoo on leading the way in conservation and responding to climate change. Ron Kagan says it all begins with kids.
Kids tend to be very receptive to wanting to do positive things. And after all, they're the ones who are going to inherit Earth and whatever is left of nature.
Bringing old Michigan folk songs back to life long after they were first sung by sailors and lumberjacks.
If we just took this music and played it the exact same way that they played it, performed it the exact same way, I'm not sure how much appeal it would have. You know, it'd be a museum piece.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Zoo is one of the greenest in the nation, thanks in large part to the leadership of Ron Kagan. Later in the show, our conversation about how Michigan's largest zoo is helping to build more awareness of humans' impact on the Earth. But first, it has been 10 days since longtime Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson died. And what a 10 days it's been, with a lot of political jockeying and infighting among Democrats and a GOP county commissioner being called out for a text she sent to fellow commissioners. And today, 21 people applied to become the next county executive. Let's turn to Mark Cabot, who's been covering all of this for the Oakland Press. Mark, today's application deadline was to finish out Patterson's term, which expires when?
His term expires December 31st, 2020.
Broadly speaking, then, without, you know, a litany of 21 names, what kinds of people applied?
So we have people with political backgrounds. We have those that have never held any kind of political public elected positions. We do have Dave Woodward, the former chairman of the Board of Commissioners, who resigned last week. He has applied. Kevin Howley, he was the Democratic nominee in 2012 for Oakland County Executive. He has filed an application. So we have a plethora of different backgrounds here that the committee will be considering tomorrow or over the next few days.
And we've been hearing an awful lot in the last week or so about Dave Woodward and also County Treasurer Andy Meisner. But Meisner did not apply.
He did not apply. He's been pretty critical of this appointment process, seeking an open and transparent process, which he did not believe was happening before. And he will be seeking the nomination in 2020 for county executive, but he did not file an application for this time.
Now, the text message. When an elected official sends out a text message to colleagues saying, and I'm quoting here, "Emergency, read now. You are about to receive FOIAs for all your email regarding Brooks' replacement. Delete, delete, delete," in caps, with exclamation points. A text like that is going to grab attention. So tell us about this message. Who sent it and what's it about?
So Shelley Taub, longtime county commissioner, she's Republican. She sent the text message to her fellow Republicans on the board. There are 9 other Republicans on the board, including herself. And she caught wind. She told me, I interviewed her yesterday, she caught wind that a local media outlet was going to submit a FOIA request for all email communications between commissioners involving L. Brooks Patterson's replacement. And so she told me that she did not send the text to hide anything from the public or ask of her fellow Republican commissioners to do anything illegal. What she told me was that some people subscribe to certain things on their personal emails that they may not want the public to know about. And so that was her intention. That's what she told me.
What are the legal implications of that message? An elected official urging other elected officials to delete emails, irrespective of what she says she meant.
I mean, I have filed a FOIA seeking all email communications between commissioners to see what's going on and what kind of communications were happening between the commissioners. But at this time, I don't know what her intentions were. But like she told me, her intentions were not to hide anything from the public or tell her commissioners to do anything illegal.
Now, she has said she won't resign.
She won't resign. Andy Meisner, Oakland County Treasurer Andy Meisner, has called for an investigation into that text message. He claims that Commissioner Taub is hiding something from the public.
You know, it has been, I think, for people reading your reports for the Oakland Press about what's been going on since Brooks Patterson died, it's kind of been like a political Hunger Games for these last few days on the Democratic side, no?
It has. And initially, within 2 days of L. Brooks Patterson's passing, former board chair Dave Woodward called for a special meeting to be held to consider an appointment to the executive county executive position. That meeting was then canceled and moved a second time. It was then moved a third time. So a lot of jockeying, a lot of, changes in decision-making here over the past week and a half with the Board of Commissioners.
So now what?
So we have 21 applicants, a three-member candidate evaluation committee comprised of two Democratic county commissioners, one Republican county commissioner. They will pick a few of those 21 applicants to interview tomorrow at beginning at 9:30 a.m. in Pontiac. Those interviews are open to the public. They'll be held at the Board of Commissioners Auditorium, 1200 North Telegraph Road in Pontiac, Michigan. And the residents will be allowed to see which, the 21 applicants are finalists and who will be interviewed by the committee. The committee will then make a recommendation to the board for consideration at their meeting on Friday to appoint county executive.
And then things begin looking at kind of the jockeying and the politics of getting in line for the long-term appointment for the election.
Right, the general election for a full four-year term. This appointee, to be clear, would finish out Brooks Patterson's term, which ends December 2020. If that appointee wants to seek the county executive seat beyond that point, they would have to run for election next year in the November general. There will be a full four-year term. Right now, Dave Woodward, the former Board of Commissioners chairman, he, like I said, filed an application to seek the temporary appointment, but he's also seeking the full four-year term next year, in addition to Andy Meisner. We don't have any filed Republicans yet, but we do have Woodward and Meisner on the Democratic side.
Mark Cabot with the Oakland Press. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Cynthia, for having me.
For children who live below the poverty line, school is often one of the few reliable places where they can get a healthy meal. So what about when summer break rolls around? Many school districts offer places where students can get meals during the summer, but Swartz Creek Community Schools in Genesee County recognize those locations don't help students who don't have reliable transportation. Swartz Creek is where more than 50% of students qualify for free or reduced lunch. So it came up with a new approach, a food bus they call the Dragon Diner. Stateside's Adam Reyes hopped aboard the Dragon Diner during its maiden voyage and brought back this audio postcard.
Michael Wenzel, I'm the food service director for Swartz Creek Community Schools.
So as you approach, there is a giant red and white trimmed school bus. You see a square platform with stairs leading up and off of it with a kind of a descriptive marquee in front of it that shows what our menu is for today, which is a bacon cheeseburger, a chicken patty sandwich, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and sides or carrots, fruit cups, and then you can have either milk or juice for your drink. We see a couple of students actually coming up now, our first customers.
Are you eating, honey? What do you want, a bacon cheeseburger or chicken sandwich?
My name is April, and I'm from Swartz Creek. I have four sons, Jaden, Jordan, Antonio, and Ashton.
And how old are you, Antonio?
Five.
What are you eating right now? What's on your tray?
Chicken sandwich and fruit.
Do you think the food here is good?
Yeah.
I feel like it's good, especially when you're a busy mom of four. So instead of having to make them lunch, you can just walk them up here and they can get their lunch.
So we have about 3,900 kids district-wide. So we're looking at about 2,200 kids qualify for these free or reduced meals. Taking that into consideration, our program for the summer is 100% free.
Thanks, guys.
Right now, we've identified about 8 locations community-wide where we'd like to go. We're going to go try and do 4 locations a week, differentiating between breakfast and lunch each week. We pull up, set everything up, open up our window, and for an hour, our scheduled serving time, anyone under the age of 22 can get up on there and we'll give them a free meal. Typically, we'll have 2 to 3 choices, a hot, a cold option. You'll be able to have milk, fresh fruits and vegetables, like real food that we're making from scratch, most of it.
I'm here with Nancy Reiser, assistant cook at Swartz Creek Middle School. Nancy, what are you working on right now?
I am cutting cucumbers and bagging them in half-cup portions. Today is our first ride out on the bus. I think it's a good program to get food out for the kids who can't make it to the locations like the high school, Moorish and Deke, because we have 3 stable locations. So hopefully we get a good turnout. Hopefully we feed 100 kids.
My name is Ebony Dixon, and I'm the property manager here at Berkshire Point Apartments in Swartz Creek, Michigan. I got an email personally and asked if they could come here on site and park the food truck for the community kids. I think it's an awesome idea. That's why it was no hesitation. What do you need to do? Where do they need to park? Do I need to put out notices? We even knocked on doors and called residents to make them aware so everyone can be a part of what's going on today.
My name is Mary Penrod, and I work for Swartz Creek Schools in the Food Service and Transportation Department. My husband brought our two grandkids up for lunch today. They're residents of Swartz Creek and very excited about the bus.
I'm Brody.
What are you eating, Brody?
I think it's a wonderful program for kids that can't get out and can't utilize some of the other places where they may offer the free foods. We come into neighborhoods like this where the transportation may be an issue and bring the food to the kids. They can walk up, ride their bikes, tell their neighbors, and just have a free meal.
Come here, baby. Honey, where's your sisters?
Shortly after we started this project, we received a phone call from Brazosport ISD over in Texas, and they had read the story that we were doing and are in the process now of replicating something similar to that. And I think that's kind of amazing that a project that we started up here in Flint, Michigan has already reached, you know, the Gulf Coast, essentially. I think once people see kind of what we're doing, I think we're going to get a lot more traction and see a lot more schools trying to replicate it, because given the outpouring of support that we've had from the community, I think it's a no-brainer that we're going to see a lot more coming soon.
Here you go, sweetheart.
Since that first lunch on July 22nd, Swartz Creek Food Services Director Michael Wenzel said the Dragon Diner has been serving an average of 80 students a day. The bus will stop summer service August 23rd, but he said they plan to use it on snow days during the winter. In 1938, Alan Lomax spent months traveling around Michigan recording folk songs. And now a group of West Michigan musicians is reinterpreting that music for today.
Even if this is not the exact same thing that it was when they sang it, that's the way folk music happens. It evolves. It evolves to have staying power in the current moment.
That story coming up right here on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we swing into the tail end of summer, fear not, there is still plenty of great theater being done by professional theater companies around the state. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now to tell us more. And we start with the always reliable Barn Theater in Augusta.
Yeah, they are doing Mamma Mia. And I don't know, Cynthia, do we really need to go into the story here? It's one of the most often performed shows the world over. It's a mother whose daughter's getting married in Greece, and she's never told her daughter the identity of her own father. And so three old boyfriends of the mama come to the Greek island where the wedding's going to take place at the invitation of the daughter. The mother does not know. It's a situation.
Of course.
But the real star, as you and I both know, is the ABBA music. In fact, the whole show was written as an excuse to fill it with the music from the Swedish 1970s pop band. And I understand you're a fan.
I am. I remember watching them win the Eurovision Song Contest in 1974 when I was going to school in Ireland. They won with Waterloo. It's fun music. And yeah, it's a jukebox musical, but it's great music. Let's just get everybody in the mood. This is Dancing Queen from the London West End cast recording. Everybody's moods just picked up.
I imagine at times I feel a little bit like a dancing queen. I'm sure everybody does. It's guilty pleasure music. So, and it's very popular. And the Barn does these kinds of shows really, really well. Have not seen it, but I can kind of vouch for it in advance because I'd be stunned if it wasn't terrific.
All right, so that is Dancing Queen, and we can thank the always reliable Barn Theater in Augusta for bringing us that. And now we've got two companies offering the same play.
Yeah, so the Mason Street Warehouse in Saugatuck is opening The Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder this weekend. And for listeners who have not seen this or heard of it, this is a really delicious, very funny musical. It takes place in the first years of the 20th century in England, and Monty Dicequiff is a ne'er-do-well, and upon his death, upon the death of his mother, who's a washerwoman, he learns that she was actually part of this aristocratic family, and that he is in fact the ninth earl in line for the family's estate and fortune. So he goes about plotting the murders of all the earls ahead of him. The play's based on a novel, came out in the early days of the last century, and then it was made into a very good movie in the 40s with Alec Guinness. It was called Kind Hearts and Coronets. Think of Downton Abbey, but with a lot of wonderful comedy, great songs, double entendre, funny stuff. I actually love the writing of this show. It's a broad comedy, but unlike some other shows, I think the writing is really, really good. And so that's at the Mason Street Warehouse in Saugatuck. And that theater is run by Kurt Stamm, who's a Broadway director and choreographer. Their stuff is consistently top drawer. So, again, haven't seen it yet, but I have little doubt that it'll be very good.
Okay, and then who else is doing Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder?
So that'll be at the Dio Dinner Theater and Entertainment in Pinckney. They open the weekend of August 23rd. And I know who the Dio has cast in the two leads, David Mohn and Richard Payton. These are two of the very best actors, musical theater actors, that we have in Michigan working today. And so my expectations are very high. And at the Dio, it's a terrific atmosphere. You get, I mean, the shows are very good. You get a nice dinner, too. It's like, I can highly recommend the fried chicken, but check the menu on their website, the Dio Dining and Entertainment, because when they do a show like this, they often tweak the menu to kind of offer something that's consistent with the show or the period of time that the show is set.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Yeah. All right. Now we head to Walled Lake and the new Jet Theater.
Oh, yeah, Cynthia, I saw Ain't Misbehavin' at the new Jet last weekend.
Oh, good morning, Mrs. Hemingway. How are you today? All right. Oh, very, very good. And yourself? Oh, you do?
This is the Fats Waller musical review. Though not all of the music is actually by Waller, I was knocked out. These actors and performers are so good. Alvin Waddles, who's an absolute treasure in Michigan, he plays the piano, and he's kind of the Fats Waller character, and the ensemble around him, which is Lauren Lestrada, Alan Briggs, Ashley Lyle, and Elizabeth Ann Gray. They're all Michigan actors. And it was so good. My face hurt when I was leaving because of how wonderful it was, how much it made me smile. So can't talk that one up enough. And this coming weekend is the last chance to see it.
And you've got one more tip for us.
Yeah, so I'm kind of excited about this. There's a new theater company in Flint called the Flint Theater Guild. It actually opened the beginning of the summer. And this weekend, they are concluding a run of the play Painting Churches. This is a play about a daughter who's an artist in New York, and she goes to Boston to help her elderly parents and pack up the house in preparation to a move to Cape Cod. This play came out in the early 80s, and it's very much about the time of life when adult children are kind of transitioning to having to look after their older parents. And that time of life is full of plot lines, and this is a very good play. I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to see it this weekend. But I also just want to say, how great is it that we have another professional theater opening in Flint? They're performing at the University of Michigan Flint Theater, and I just want to wish them well for everything they're going to do in the future.
Well, we have lots of theater around the state, from the new Flint Theater Guild, the new Jet Theater in Walled Lake, the Mason Street Warehouse in Saugatuck, the Dio Dinner Theater in Pinckney, and the Barn Theater in Augusta. Details on these productions, as always, are waiting for you at EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thanks you. Let me try that again. David Kiley, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 81 summers ago, famed folklorist Alan Lomax visited Michigan. He traveled around the state recording and documenting folk music.
Oh, they sent us in a country, the road we did not know. Orders up on the Rifle River in Michigan, I-O.
Many of the recordings from that 1938 trip are now in the Library of Congress. Hearing about Lomax's time in Michigan inspired a group of West Michigan musicians to bring some of those old Michigan folk songs back to life. The result? Their new album, Michigan I.O. We welcome two of those musicians now, Aaron Cates, Noah McLaren. Welcome to the show. Noah, talk to us about the process of digging up these old songs and just what it took to get them onto this new album.
So we started by choosing a few of the songs. There are hundreds of them. So we asked one of our bandmates, Jonathan Gabhart, to go into the Library of Congress archives himself and choose some of his favorites, songs that he thought that we could do well. And then we shared the task of developing the basic arrangements. So we each added the chords. We thought, is this song in a minor key or a major key? Do I need to raise the key? Some of these folks that are on the Lomax recordings sing so low that it's sort of a growl that makes it onto the recording. and sort of make it a little more musical, mm-hmm. we would need to raise it three or four steps or more.
You've got to kind of almost guess at what the melody is, because when you hear some of these things, again, as Noah said, they're almost growling, and it's almost more of a chant than an actual tune that comes through on the recording. So you just have to, you got to kind of guess and put a more defined tune to it, which can be a difficult task.
But it's a reminder to everybody, folk music is not carved in stone, right? It's very fluid. It changes. So you were able mm-hmm. to take this raw material and kind of put your own stamp on them.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've been talking about is even if this is not the exact same thing that it was when they sang it, that's the way folk music happens. It evolves. It evolves to have staying power in the current moment, right? If we just took this music and played it the exact same way that they played it, performed it the exact same way, I'm not sure how much appeal it would have. You know, it'd be a museum piece rather than a piece that actually fits in our current cultural milieu right now.
Now, it seems, as I listen to the tracks on Michigan I.O., that the lion's share of Michigan's folk songs came from lumberjacks and from Great Lakes sailors. Am I right on that?
Least, seems like it, yep.
At least the ones that Lomax was able to track down in his 3 months mm-hmm. through Michigan. He came back from that trip saying that there was probably decades worth of work to be done. And then he spent the rest of his career in the Appalachians, for the most part, I think. So, but he did. He fit every, I think, crevice of his car with recording mm-hmm. reels.
And do we have any idea, like, how old some of these songs might be?
The best I can do is point you to the origin of the industries of these. Ore mining started around, I think, in the 1850s in Michigan. I'm not sure exactly how far back the lumberjack stories mm-hmm. go, but there are a few that probably originated in Europe and were brought over. So I think the peddler, for instance, references a lot of place names that are not American places. They're European cities. So I think that one traveled with sailors across the ocean. And there are more in the Lomax archives, one called The First Day of April, which we're starting to play now in our live set and have targeted for Volume 2 of Michigan I.O.
When oh.
we when we get around to that.
There's more
which
to
is,
come.
It's
there coming.
Is definitely more
Be
to
prepared.
Come.
All right, so let me start with asking Aaron Cates, what is your favorite song on the album? Which one do you want to spotlight?
Probably the title track, Michigan I.O.
If you will pay good wages, my passes to and fro, I'll go spend the winter lumbering in Michigan, I hope.
You know, this is a project that is documenting some of the cultural treasures of Michigan and giving honor to our state. But at the same time, it's a little bit of a jab at Michigan. It talks about suffering these long, miserable winters in the lumber camps.
We'll go home to our wives and sweethearts. Tell others not to go to that godforsaken country called Michigan, I hope.
I think we can kind of commiserate with them on a certain level, which is something that I think is kind of fun. You know, Michigan is not all fun and games. it gives a very clear picture of what life can be like in the North Woods in the deep gray of winter sometimes.
And it's a surprising sort of turn. And then audiences today laugh, and I smile when I sing it. I cannot sing this song with a straight face because it's funny that all of a sudden we turn from celebrating to, oh, wait a second, that was really hard work they
yeah.
did.
Yeah. Oh, say there is no bigger hell than Michigan I.O. That's pretty
acerbic.
So much for pure Michigan,
yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah. Noah McLaren, what song do you want to highlight?
My favorite, far and away, is Red Iron Ore.
Come all you bold sailors that follow the lakes. On an iron ore vessel you're living to make.
It tells the story of one freighter traveling from Chicago. It traces its journey up through the coast of Wisconsin to Escanaba.
Bound for Escanaba for red iron ore.
In Escanaba, they loaded themselves down with more iron ore than they probably should have carried. And it's a story of triumph in the end, how through storms and just too much weight, they made it home ahead of the rest of the fleet. So I love, first of all, how big the story is and how much the journey encompasses for them. And then that they get to stand up in a bar in Cleveland and say, hey, gents, listen to my story.
Come all ye boat sailors that follow the lake.
Yeah. Now the Roberts in Cleveland made fast stern and stem. Over the bottle will spin a big yarn. The cap of your Shannon had ought to stand trees. Getting to Cleveland ahead of the fleet.
Why do you think these songs like Yankee Brown or Johnny Carl's Lumber Camp or Traverse City, why do they speak to us in 2019? I mean, what insights into the minds and lives of these long ago people do we relate to in 2019?
Something that's interesting is that we have kind of this, there's the cultural myth of the lumberjack. It's not something where we contemplate the reality of these people who lived here in our state and worked in our state, right? You know, so to be able to have these songs that give us this window into life right here, you know, they were lumbering right here. Grand Rapids, where we're recording this interview, was, you know, they used to float logs right down this river. You know, this is not this crazy faraway thing. You know, this is, you know, just a couple generations ago, this is what people were doing here. So it just helps kind of connect us to the past, what happened to our land. You know, that pretty much the entire state of Michigan was cut over and was pretty much an environmental wasteland after this industry came and left. And that's something that I think we forget. So I think these are really grounding for our place and for the people who live here and call it home.
So any opportunities to play these songs live for people?
Sure. Yeah, we have a show that's on the books for November 1st at Wealthy Street Theater here in Grand Rapids.
Well, fun to get your insights, and I loved the music. Aaron Cates, Noah McLaren, part of the group that put out this new album, Michigan I.O., their interpretation of traditional Michigan folk songs collected back in the summer of 1938 by folklorist Alan Lomax. Thanks for sharing your passion with us on Stateside.
Of course.
Thanks, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's plenty of reason to feel overwhelmed, powerless in the face of environmental and conservation challenges. But there are those leading community conversations about conservation and climate change, conservation and climate change through education and by example. One group working to that end is the Detroit Zoo. For the past 16 years, the Detroit Zoo has done strategic planning around green efforts. In fact, the Detroit Zoo has been recognized as one of the greenest zoos in the U.S. for its sustainability initiatives. Here now is the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, Ron Kagan. Ron, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Ron, when did you know that teaching about climate change would be an important part of the mission of the Detroit Zoo?
Probably about 20 years ago. When a lot of us in the conservation community began to see some strange developments. I mean, literally, climate change had already started to affect wildlife populations. So for us, it wasn't any more a theoretical discussion. We began to realize it was a real issue and already having an impact.
What were some of those examples that you could tell us?
Well, so one of the things that was happening is we saw in Antarctica, for instance, Adelie penguins, populations were dwindling along the Antarctic Peninsula. And this became kind of a detective mystery. We know that krill, which are these sort of miniature shrimp that are in the oceans all over the world and really feed so much of aquatic life in oceans, that krill were disappearing from some of these areas, which the krill are eaten by the penguins, not just penguins, but by Adelie penguins. They were disappearing. We also were seeing Adelie penguin nests that were beginning to melt right when the chicks were hatching. And the Adelies are hardwired. They're not, they don't sort of look at a problem and go, okay, well, I guess we need to move to a colder area. These are breeding areas that they've been to for probably millions of years. So a lot of chicks were not surviving. So you begin to see things which normally in nature don't happen quickly. And by quickly, I mean over the course of several years. Normally changes, again, unless there is a meteor that hits Earth or there are a whole bunch of volcanoes that explode, you don't see changes like this happening quickly. And we saw that happening just over the course of a few years, that there were some major population changes happening.
Give us an idea of some of the initiatives that you've brought to the zoo and have the zoo doing that kind of bring this idea of climate change and conservation to the forefront. Just maybe people don't even realize they're getting kind of preached to as they go through the zoo.
Well, we do. It's interesting you use that word. We do want to avoid sounding preachy. Mm-hmm. We do want to help people understand important issues. And they are issues that are shared by humans and non-humans, non-human animals as well. So there are quite a few things that we do. And to some extent, we try to bring people on a journey with us because we've been on a journey, and we call it the Green Print Journey. Actually, people can go to our website at DetroitZoo.org and they can download our green print. They can download something that they can actually put in their wallets called Shades of Green, which gives them dozens of examples of things that we all can do in our daily lives. But we have, for instance, Science on a Sphere, which was developed by NOAA and NASA. And it shows Earth, and in both real time and accelerated time, we can show what's been happening, what's going to happen. It's a very, I mean, we're only one of two zoos in the world that has it, and it's a very powerful tool because one of the things that it can do is compress time. And for humans, unless you see cause and effect immediately, people sometimes don't really understand the connection of what we do and what the impact is. And Science on a Sphere can accelerate time so that you can actually see very quickly what's been happening, for instance, to the polar ice caps, which is an obvious example of global warming. But we also have a smart flower, which is, again, one of only two in the country, actually, and a very interesting solar device that tracks the sun. And it's always at maximum attack angle, so it's 40% more efficient than any solar device can be. And it's right in the center on the mall, so people immediately are drawn to this. It's such an unusual device. And we explain what's going on. We explain renewable energy. We do the same with water. So we have lots and lots of water, filtered water filling stations, and we don't sell plastic water bottles at the zoo and have them for many years. We have a beautiful Michigan wetlands boardwalk, and the whole boardwalk is made out of recycled plastic bottle caps. You know, I can go on and on. There are just so many different things throughout the anaerobic digester, which takes our 1 million pounds of animal waste, converts it into methane, which then powers a generator, which then powers our animal health complex. And all of these things have educational components to them so that it's not just what we're doing, but we're explaining to our 1.4 million visitors a year, which is the key, because there are lots of great environmental organizations, but very few actually have direct contact with so many people every year. So for us, it's both a responsibility and a great opportunity to try to get people to understand issues and especially solutions.
And do you feel that the kind of messages that you've just shared with us, that the zoo is demonstrating at all times, you think that's reaching groups who might otherwise tune it out or shrug it off, the issues of climate change and conservation?
Well, it's difficult. When you do studies and evaluations of visitors, you can generally get a sense of before and after a visit, but not long after a visit. That's really tough. And as we all know, all of us are bombarded with lots of messages, and in some cases, there are messages that are meant to confuse the public about climate change, which is really a tragedy because we don't have any time left. I mean, you know, during the past five mass extinction events, generally, anywhere from 65 to 85% of all species have become extinct. Now, new species evolve, but normally that recovery takes 10 to 30 million years. Obviously, humans don't have 10 to 30 million years to recover.
Sure.
And we're now in the Anthropocene, and we potentially will lose a million species before the century is out. That will take millions of years to recover from, and the question is, will we even be able to withstand that?
And when you think of the severity and the implications of climate change, how do you strike a balance between these realities and educating kids in particular about climate change without scaring them?
Well, you know, to your point, we don't want to preach.
Right.
You know, people don't come to public places for that. And so this is really, it is about facts. It is about trying to focus on solutions, trying to help people understand the connectivity of all things on Earth. And there really are things that can be done. Some of this is complicated, and that is a real challenge. You know, climate science is extremely complicated. Even the climate experts have lots of challenges of explaining the differences of what methane does in the atmosphere and what CO2 does and carbon sequestration. And I mean, there are a lot of complicated elements to all of this. But I think the one thing that we're able to do is people love nature, and we try to, of course, encourage that and foster that and try to encourage people to be more thoughtful about how every step we take, literally and figuratively, can have an impact, and it can have a positive impact, but it also can have a negative impact. Kids tend to be very receptive to wanting to do positive things, and after all, they're the ones who are going to inherit Earth and whatever is left of nature. So there are many, many things that all of us can do differently, that some of them are small, and they all add up. It's a little bit like voting. People that don't vote because they say, well, my vote isn't really going to count because there are millions of people. If enough people do that, then democracy doesn't work.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, Ron Kagan. You have been to Antarctica, Ron. Why did you go? And tell us what that experience was like for you. What really stuck with you from that visit?
Well, I've been to Antarctica now 6 times. And in fact, while this is anecdotal, it certainly supports the evidence. Over the course of the past 25 or 30 years, I have seen dramatic changes in Antarctica. And it is as close, I think, as you can get to traveling to another world. The scale of things, the extreme nature of the environment is incredible. But at the same time, that's one of the ways that we visually can see dramatic changes with climate, because the polar ice caps are shrinking, and they're shrinking dramatically, especially the north, but also in Antarctica. Antarctica is a place where we work with a scientist at the Palmer Station. There are 3 U.S. stations in Antarctica. He's been doing ecological research there for over 40 years, and we've been working with him now for probably 6 or 7 years. He's been documenting for the entire time that he's been there the ecological changes in Antarctica. It is still a spectacular place, but it is changing so quickly.
And I know that the state-of-the-art penguin facility at the Detroit Zoo, it's like an interactive trip to Antarctica for the folks who go there. Was it designed, Ron, with the intention of drawing people into both the positive and negative impacts of human beings on the natural world around them?
What a wonderful question, because that's exactly what we did. So, in fact, the exterior of the building evokes images of a tabular iceberg. In fact, when Bill Fraser, the scientist I was just telling you about, first saw the design, he said, "When were you at my research station?" And we said, "Well, actually, this isn't from there, but it is from Antarctica, and it's cracking in half. That's what you see." And that is evoking the concept that we are losing ice, and that is problematic. I think the other thing is that not only do we have lots of messaging in that facility, but we also at the end have opportunities for people to take action that will help the environment and do the reverse. So you're given options of, for instance, you know, if we all ate less meat, there'd be a lot less methane that goes into the atmosphere. Methane traps the heat, it's a heat blanket that's far more damaging actually than CO2. It just doesn't last as long as the atmosphere in the atmosphere. So we could dramatically reduce methane, which comes from all of the dairy industry, if we use less dairy products. There are lots of choices you can make. Using recycled bags and many other things, turning off lights when you leave a room. I mean, some of these things sound very small, but they all add up. And so in the Polk Center, we make sure that you are excited about Antarctica. We take you there via Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, which is an incredible experience.
It is, yeah.
And he was a hero of mine from, I don't know, I think I was probably 8 when I read his story. But it's an incredible experience and gets people very, very interested. And, of course, the penguins are spectacular. So, again, this is partly drawing people in to remind them of biophilia, the innate love of nature that humans have, and then trying to encourage them to think about what the impacts are of our daily lives and the various things we can do to help and minimize the human impact on climate change.
Looking into the future, Ron, how do you want Detroit's zoo to lead conservation efforts and climate change awareness?
Well, I'm happy to say that we've been recognized with a number of very wonderful awards, including being named the greenest zoo in the United States by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. I think that whatever we do, and we have four main mission pillars, sustainability is one of them, animal welfare is another, education is another, and conservation is the other one. Whatever we do, we want to have the most impact possible. There are many things we can't and shouldn't do. It's not our expertise. So we don't focus on tropical animals because we're not in the right climate for that. But in terms of sustainability, I don't know that there's anything more pressing for a conservation organization to work on. And this absolutely connects to the biodiversity challenge. And people need to understand that, you know, nature is very complicated and things really are connected. And every time we lose a species or lose a habitat, things begin to break down. I don't remember who it was who said this years ago, but you can think of it as a metaphor of a plane. And a plane can lose a whole bunch of rivets and still fly, but then it's that one last rivet, and then the whole thing unravels. I don't know if we're at a tipping point, but we're in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. We already know the temperatures have rised over 1.5 degrees Celsius. We're probably on track to go up as much as 3 degrees Celsius, which is enormous and will really be devastating. Climate change obviously is affecting sea levels. If all of the ice melts on Antarctica, sea levels around the world will go up 200 feet. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling numbers.
It is, indeed. Ron, let's end on this note. What signs have you found that are encouraging, positive changes that have happened or give you hope for the future?
Well, I think, not surprisingly, the young people give us a lot of hope. I do think we aren't where we could or should be with respect to governmental policies, at least not in the U.S. I mean, there are isolated places that really have taken this very seriously, others that don't seem to really want to believe it. And I, you know, to me, the notion of what not believing facts doesn't really make any sense. But I think that it's the young people. You know, we need to encourage kids, and we need to get into schools, both in formal and informal science education. We obviously are not the only ones doing this. I think most science institutions, science museums, aquariums, zoos, all need to do a lot. We should not be strictly focused on animals. We should be really focused on the bigger picture.
Ron Kagan is the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, and it certainly seems like the message is individuals do have the power to affect change. You can go to DetroitZoo.org to learn more about Greenprint, Shades of Green, and so many other initiatives at the Detroit Zoo. Ron, thank you so very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we talk to the new president of Michigan State University. Samuel Stanley was chosen to be the university's 21st president and lead the institution out of the controversies surrounding Larry Nassar and former Dean William Strample, former President Luana K. Simon, and others. How does he plan to move MSU forward? We'll ask him next time on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.